Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
From the Times and the Sunday Times, this is The Story. I'm Manveen Rana. Early 2011, the war in Afghanistan had been raging for almost a decade. In Helmand, the SAS were carrying out a deadly series of secret night raids. They were supposed to be capturing Taliban insurgents, but it wasn't until an explosive investigation by the Sunday Times in 2017 that we realised this was a unit that had gone rogue.
The SAS was being investigated for executing people in their homes on night raids, and then after killing the people, they would then leave guns by their side to make it look as if the victim had been killed in self-defense, which was an extraordinary story. And when we wrote it initially, there was almost disbelief, because nobody, I don't think, would ever have thought that British soldiers execute people in cold blood in that way.
It was a shocking story, and over the course of the next few years, the team at the Sunday Times kept digging. But every story they published faced a wall of denial.
The Ministry of Defence at the time was really sort of trying to play down the story. They said there was no evidence to support it, no soldiers had been arrested, there was only one case of unlawful killing in Afghanistan that was being investigated. But our subsequent reporting ultimately led years down the line to an independent inquiry into 80 Afghan killings, which is currently taking place in the High Court.
That judge-led inquiry has forced thousands of top-secret MOD documents out into the open, and they reveal startling evidence that the SAS committed multiple murders and that the crimes were covered up by the authorities.
The documents that have come out include statements of the police from British soldiers alleging war crimes by the SAS, witness accounts by SAS commanders, emails warning Downing Street about the killings, and diaries of the police investigators. So it's given us a kind of extraordinary, unprecedented insight into what was really happening.
For the first time, we can see the extent of the crimes allegedly committed by the SAS and the cover-up that followed.
When you actually put it together as a whole story, what envelops is this kind of extraordinary scandal, not only about the fact that these people were being executed in Afghanistan, allegedly, but also an extraordinary story of how the police investigation into it was muffled, and there was seemed to be a cover-up at the heart of government about it.
And now we can also see that one brave whistleblower inside the special forces tried to do the right thing. The story today: the SAS murders and the conspiracy to cover them up. Part one. This story is one of many that only came to light because of the extraordinary work done by the crack team of investigators at the Sunday Times.
I'm Jonathan Calvert. I'm the editor of the Insight team at the Sunday Times.
And Jonathan is one half of an investigative double act. Wherever you find Jonathan, you'll find George.
And I'm George Arbuthnot, and I'm the deputy editor of the Insight team.
And the story we're talking about today, this is something you've been covering for years. There is so much here. We're going to spend 2 episodes of the podcast looking at all of this. So we'll get a lot more of the detail in a moment. But before we do, just give us a sense of the headlines of what you found from these new documents. What were the bits that were most startling for you?
So one of the elements that has never been reported before at all was that it revealed that one of the most senior special forces officers in the British Army had actually broken ranks and reported to the police that SAS soldiers under his own command had committed war crimes by executing prisoners in Afghanistan. And the officer was actually overseeing all the special forces operations at the time, and he whistleblowed to the Royal Military Police and said that a cancer had infected a rogue SAS squadron that had murdered dozens of unarmed detainees. And he came forward despite the risk because their crimes were so serious that the entire regiment should be overhauled.
I mean, that's extraordinary for somebody within that particular unit to be blowing the whistle like that, and given the dangers.
Yeah, and what's so significant about it was that in the past, we had obviously got evidence from the victims' families, but we had never appreciated that the soldiers' own commanders believed they had committed war crimes and felt so strongly about it that actually were going to risk their own family's safety to bring it to light, which obviously provides a whole new sense of credibility to the allegations.
Tell us a bit more about this man, you know, what we are allowed to say.
As with a lot of special forces soldiers, apart from the ones who are actually in charge of kind of special forces overall, there's great secrecy about their names. But we know enough about this particular man, who in the inquiries called N1466, that he was assistant chief of staff of operations to the director of special forces, who at the time was Major General Jacko Page. He clearly enjoyed a stellar career to have risen so high in special forces. And he had commanded units in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's quite clear from the documents. And by 2011, he'd risen to become the assistant chief of staff of operations. And he was based in special forces headquarters, which is at the MOD in central London. And apart from that, we know very little more about him other than that it was his job to be in charge of all special forces operations, both at home and abroad, which meant that when he came forward as a whistleblower, he was an extraordinary whistleblower.
Yeah, and he was so senior that he was actually number 3 in the Special Forces Directorate, the 3rd highest ranking officer there.
And the fact that he had experience on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan meant he knew what he was talking about with these night raids and how many people should be dead at the end of them.
Yes, we have excerpts from his witness statement, and you can see that he, as a kind of special forces commander, understands entirely the nature of the operations, and therefore he understands how entirely these explanations for some of the killings by the SAS were just unbelievable.
Tell us about that. At what point does he become alarmed?
At the time, N1466's main focus was on Afghanistan, where from 2009 to 2013, the SAS was operating a kind of relentless campaign of night raids against suspected Taliban insurgents. So their job was to try and capture suspected ringleaders or bomb makers and gather evidence of any militant activity before taking them back to base, where they could be held for up to 96 hours. But most of the suspects who were captured were released, as it was hard to gather enough evidence to prove that they were insurgents. And we've had a kind of insight into the way these capture raids were initiated. So we've spoken to Captain Mike Martin, who was a fluent Pashto speaker, who was the army's first cultural understanding officer in Afghanistan at the time. And he was actually attended these confidential meetings where the SAS identified targets. And he's described his severe misgivings about the flawed intelligence that was used to justify the raids, and said that he was actually excluded from the meetings after pleading with the SAS to stop killing innocent people. And he says they acted on very poor intelligence, even when they knew it was poor. The SAS would go in and kill members of a family based on faulty information. The next morning, there would be people going, "What was going on last night? You just murdered a whole family."
Wow.
So there was extreme concern that they were basically being far too cavalier about their attempts to really decapitate the Taliban. But unfortunately, the evidence suggests that a lot of the victims were actually innocent civilians.
But as you say, the SAS were there from 2009 until 2013. That's quite a long period. And yet there's something happens in 2011 when it feels like those killings are accelerated.
By February 2011, I think N1466 and other senior commanders in the SAS are becoming extremely concerned because it's gone beyond being cavalier. And it's not about being kind of careless about killing people.
Which was bad enough.
Well, exactly, yeah. Yes. There was one particular squadron that was 9 weeks into its six-month tour of duty in Afghanistan, and that squadron's post-mission reports after a particular raid. And it showed that large numbers of Afghan citizens were being killed rather than captured. By February 2011, the complaints had come from as high up as the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, in particular about one of the killings, the shooting of someone called Mohammed Ibrahim, who was a civilian former district governor in Helmand province. He was 55 and he'd previously worked alongside British forces and had not been a target of the SAS raid.
But he doesn't sound like a candidate for a Taliban.
No, he doesn't. And that was the reason it was raised by the president. But there was something about the way he was killed, which would later emerge to be quite a pattern, which was that when the SAS had captured him in his home, take him outside, and then at gunpoint, they would take people back into the house to help them search the premises. And while this was happening, according to the post-mission report by the SAS, this 55-year-old man grabbed a grenade from behind a curtain and was instantly gunned down by the SAS soldiers who were following him. It's a suicidal act. It looks very, very different, but that was the SAS's account of it. And it became quite clear after a while that there had been a number of incidents where people had come out of the house, surrendered, been captured by the SAS. In some cases, they had their hands tied, and then they were taken back into the premises to help with the search of the home and were said to have even tried to grab an AK-47 rifle or a grenade, and they were executed.
So they surrender outside, they're taken in to their own homes by the SAS, and somehow, by the end of it, always end up dead.
Yeah.
What were commanders like N1466? What were they making of these reports as they came in? I know you've seen some of the emails between them.
So on the nights of the 7th and 9th of February 2011, the squadron had shot dead 17 people, including two children, in their homes during two raids. But they'd only recovered seven weapons from the scene. And N1466 was looking at these mission reports and was becoming increasingly alarmed. And he actually emailed his concerns to the Director of Special Forces, General Page, warning that the unit was out of control. And Page's chief of staff also received another email from another worried officer, who was a lieutenant colonel, also in charge of Special Forces operations. And he wrote, "I find it incredible the amount of Afghan males that the SAS unit send back into a building, who then decide to get weapons or grenades and engage the SAS unit, knowing that it will achieve nothing." Why come out? Why not wait for the SAS unit to come into the room and engage them in a confined space where there is a greater chance of causing casualties? Whilst murder and the UK Special Forces have often been regular bedfellows, this is beginning to look bone. Now, bone in that context means nonsense. The Chief of Staff, who is the second highest commander in Special Forces, emailed back, making reference to a recent boast by the SAS that it had killed more insurgents than a similar unit from another country, effectively suggesting that there was a kind of killing competition between them. He wrote, "I find it depressing that it has come to this, ultimately a massive failure of leadership." And he also expressed his disbelief at the SAS's explanations for the killings, saying, "If we don't believe this, then no one else will. And when the next WikiLeaks occurs, then we will be dragged down with them." I mean, they're effectively foreseeing what is happening now, 13 years later, which is there's now an inquiry into all this.
It is extraordinary to hear officers who are very high up, who know how all of this works, quite clearly alarmed by what's happening. Something else you start to see in the emails around this point, though, again, which acknowledges that the SAS knows something is wrong, is the change in the code words around those deaths. Just explain what starts popping up.
Yeah, so on the 14th of February, another commander observed in an email that the SAS appeared to be deliberately setting the conditions for the Afghans' execution by sending the detainees back into their home to help the search. And a colleague replied, "There appears to be a casual disregard for life, military principles, and credible reporting." And then 2 days later, further emails were exchanged between the Special Forces commanders at the Directorate in London, which stop calling the unit's victims EKIA, which is an acronym for Enemy Killed in Action, and they're now being called EJK, which stands for Extrajudicial Killings, or in other words, murder. And so you can see at that point that they themselves are convinced these are war crimes rather than the normal killings that would occur in war.
So at this point, inside Special Forces, there is an acknowledgement that the SAS appear to be committing a series of murders. So what do they do? Coming up, how the cover-up unfolded.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Jonathan and George, you've been telling us about this SAS squadron who some officials at the time clearly thought had gone rogue. There's a pattern of behaviour on night raids which results in a much higher number of casualties. The whistleblower officer who's very high up in the SAS at the time. We're calling him N1466, which is how he appears in the paperwork at this inquiry. He's talked about his suspicions. What happens next? Are they confirmed by any other officers?
So at the end of March 2011, N1466 attends a leaving dinner at the headquarters of the Special Boat Service, which is the other special forces unit that sits alongside the SAS. And the man leaving is actually Colonel Gwyn Jenkins, who only last month was made the National Security Advisor to the Prime Minister.
So an important character.
Very important man. After the dinner, Jenkins took N1466 to one side in the bar to share an issue that was troubling him. And what he told N146 was that the SBS troops in Afghanistan were reporting that an SAS soldier had confessed to operating a, quote, deliberate policy of executing all fighting age males.
Wow.
And an SBS officer who'd had this conversation was asked to type out a statement, which he did. The statement said that during conversations with a soldier from the SAS unit, it was said that all fighting age males are killed on target, regardless of the threat they posed. This included those not holding weapons. It was also indicated that the fighting age males were being executed on target inside compounds using a variety of methods, after they've been restrained. In one case, it was mentioned a pillow was put over the head of an individual being killed with a pistol. And the statement goes on, it was implied that photos would be taken of the deceased alongside weapons that the fighting age male may not have had in their possession when they were killed.
That's crucial. These aren't men who were reaching for weapons and about to shoot. The photos of the dead bodies have weapons in them, but they don't necessarily belong to the victims.
Yeah, I mean, there was a huge suspicion about the photographs because they looked odd. But here you have someone relating a conversation with one of the SAS unit involved, saying that's exactly what they did. They put weapons down next to them, planting weapons, in order to make it look as if the victims had been shot by soldiers who were being fired upon or feared being fired upon, when in fact the victims didn't actually have a weapon in their hands at all.
I mean, this is completely shocking. And for Jenkins, the head of the SBS, you know, his unit are not guilty of this. They're clean, as far as we know. He's heard these shocking rumours. He's seen a statement. What does he do next?
So Jenkins decided that it was serious enough to write to Page, the director of Special Forces.
This is his boss, effectively.
Yeah, exactly. The email is marked secret UK eyes only, because of its sensitivity. And he reported to Page that the allegations about the SAS were of a nature which makes me seriously concerned for the reputation of UK Special Forces and should be formally investigated. He said that in some cases this has involved the deliberate killing of individuals after they've been restrained and the subsequent fabrication of evidence to suggest lawful killing in self-defence. And Page also received a message from N1466, who said that there needed to be a deeper investigation to make a clear statement to the Special Forces, or at worst, put a stop to criminal behaviour.
Mm.
So Page was now under no illusion of the seriousness, because he had two of his most senior colleagues telling him that there needed to be a proper investigation into this.
And to add to that, the matter was coming to a head also, because when the SAS went on these night raids, they would be accompanied by Afghan Special Forces.
Mm.
Partly because they needed people to communicate, and the SAS didn't speak the language. And their Afghan partners were now refusing to serve alongside this particular SAS unit because they were so concerned about the killings.
Do we have any sense of how many people were killed?
In April 2011, N1466 was so concerned, he commissioned an analysis of some of the SAS unit's recent raids. So these were just the ones chosen. And in a way, they might, in fact, be the tip of the iceberg. We don't know. But the ones they looked at, they found that 43 Afghan men had been killed in 9 missions, while only 26 weapons were said to have been recovered. This is quite extraordinary. He found that there were 11 separate incidents where Afghan men had been shot dead after being captured and then sent back into their homes at gunpoint to help with the clearing of the home, just like we talked about earlier with Mohammed Ibrahim, which is kind of extraordinary that so many people who had surrendered in the middle of the night to soldiers raiding their homes would suddenly turn suicidal in that way.
Yeah, I mean, they've literally surrendered. The worst that can happen to them is they will be held in prison for 96 hours and then released.
Exactly.
And yet, we're told that in 11 of these incidents, they all turn and try and pull a gun.
And there was no evidence of this behaviour previously. We don't know
with
whether these
units,
people were insurgents or not, quite a lot of them, because the intelligence is so poor on them. So there's no evidence that the Taliban did this, and there's no evidence that anyone else would have done this.
So at this point, Major General Jacko Page, the Director of Special Forces, the man in charge of the SAS and the other Special Forces units, he's got this analysis from the whistleblower officer, N1466. He's got an email from the head of the SBS, Gwyn Jenkins. What does he do?
So rather than referring it to the Royal Military Police, he decides that there will be an internal review of the incidents. So what happens is a former commander of the squadron that's under investigation is sent out to Afghanistan to review what's happening and talk to the soldiers and the commanders. And it only takes a week. And the final report was actually officially offered by the overall commander of the rogue squadron itself. And you won't be surprised to hear that he accepted that the killings were in self-defense and claimed that the insurgents were trying to provoke suicidal confrontations that could be used as propaganda against the British Army. So,
wow, that's quite the spin.
Yeah, and Page accepted these explanations and the matter was closed.
I mean, that's astonishing. Having all the evidence that he's been given, he orders an internal inquiry authored by the man in charge of the road unit, effectively. He's left them to mark their own homework.
Yeah, we found that quite astonishing, actually. We saw that in the documents that exactly. The man in charge of the rogue squadron was the one doing the review. I mean, we had to kind of read it about four times to make sure we hadn't misunderstood.
And for N1466, who, you know, as you say, has risked his own life and the safety of his family to blow the whistle, to raise some of these concerns, what does he make of that internal review?
Well, he leaves it to General Jacko Page, who was the head of Special Forces, and I suppose, you know, he's a military man. Military men, especially commanders of this level, are not normally whistleblowers. But later he would tell the Royal Military Police in a witness statement that, these are his words, "I should have made it clear to Page that the issue should be taken to the service police. He felt there was enough evidence there at the time for the police to be called in to investigate these things as suspected murders."
But they weren't. What happens to the evidence, such as it is? You know, we know that there is a statement, for example, from an SBS soldier about what he's heard. What happens to it after this internal investigation?
So the statement detailing the SAS confession was placed in a safe at the SBS headquarters by Jenkins. And he later explained to the military police that it was because Page had been unhappy about the nature of the information, and that's why he'd put it into the safe. And it wouldn't see the light of day for another 3 years until N1466 finally broke ranks. As we mentioned earlier, Jenkins is about to become the Britain's new national security advisor. Questions have been raised about whether that's appropriate, given he was the one that hid this information away in the safe in 2011.
He locks this stuff away in a safe. What's the alternative history? What could he have done that would have been...
Well,
what you'd expect somebody who's about to become the NSA would have done.
It's clear that Page has decided not to refer to the Royal Military Police. And given that Jenkins and N1466 had obviously raised this and recommended that there should be a serious investigation into this, it suggests that there was significant disquiet amongst the two of them about that decision. And it was in their gift to refer it to the Royal Military Police at the time.
I think they're obliged to, aren't they?
Yeah, under the rules, it is their duty to refer any allegations of war crimes to the Royal Military Police.
George, I know you've contacted everyone we've mentioned in this story about these allegations. What did they say?
So we contacted the soldiers and civil servants that we've mentioned. Most declined to comment. An MOD spokeswoman said, "It is not appropriate for us to comment on allegations which may be within the scope of the statutory inquiry."
That was the brilliant Sunday Times Insight team, Jonathan Calvert and George Arbuthnot. We'll have more from them tomorrow when we'll hear how the pressure to close down the investigations into the SAS was now coming from the heart of government.
The locks were actually changed around the perimeter of the SAS's base in Afghanistan, which stopped the Royal Military Police entering.
They're literally being locked out of the place they're supposed to be gathering evidence.
Exactly.
If you want to read the full investigation, as well as Insight's earlier pieces on the SAS scandal, you can find them all online at thetimes.co.uk with a subscription. The producer today was Edward Drummond. The executive producer was Fiona Leach. And sound design and theme composition were by Mao Lasseto. And if you were as shocked as I was by this story, then please do pass this podcast on. Share it with a friend, leave us a review, just make sure people hear about it. And whatever you do, don't miss part two tomorrow.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.